Hi, and welcome to this latest episode of the SSP Early Career Podcast. I'm Sarah Grimmer from Digital Science, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host Meredith Adenolfi from Cell Press in Boston. Today, we're joined by Rafael Masarwyk from Springer Nature to talk about research integrity, which is a hot topic that is now impossible to avoid. I'm sure that you've all read or heard about this incredibly important topic, and some of you may even be dealing with it with your own publications. Recent research estimates that each paper retracted because of research misconduct costs taxpayers roughly $400,000, according to a report published in The Scientist. So the cost of research integrity lapses is truly staggering. And if you think about the subsequent problems caused by research fraud after publication, the price that we're all paying is immense. Rafael is the editor-in-chief of Scientific Reports, which is now the world's biggest journal. We've asked him to join us today to cover the basics of research integrity and to understand how the world's biggest journal manages research fraud. So, Rafael, it would be super if we could actually begin by you telling us a little bit about yourself and your career.
Thank you, Sarah. So I'm the chief editor of Scientific Reports. I've been with the journal since 2016, became chief editor about 3 years ago. Before that, I was editor for a journal called Genome Biology, which is a selective journal from BMC, part of Springer Nature as well. Before that, I was in research for a very brief period of time. My research background is really in analytical chemistry and its applications in biology. I have a very soft spot for single-cell proteomics as a field. You know, at the time when I was in research, it was still a field with a lot of unfulfilled potential. And now, some, 12, 13 years later, I think it still is.
And what brought you to becoming the chief editor of a mega journal? What made you make the decision to jump to such a big journal?
Oh, I think it would be a better question. I moved to Scientific Reports in the first place because my transition to chief editor was, I think, just a natural career progression. But the journal itself, when I moved in 2016, it was a challenge for me to move from the journal that's very narrow scope and selective to a journal that covers essentially all disciplines and first and foremost differs from a lot of journals at the time anyway, in terms of the editorial criteria that it applies. One of the most distinguishing features of Scientific Reports is that we don't judge submissions or, don't select papers for publication based on the perceived impact or perceived significance of the work, and instead focus on, validity and rigor of how the research has been designed and conducted. And the assessment of, what's important and what isn't, that's left to the community. Now, that's something that if you're an editor, and a lot of editors start on journals that are much more selective, it really goes a bit against all your training and how you look at research. So the challenge was something that I really just wanted to try myself in. And what pretty much came away with that, which I wasn't as prepared for, but I welcomed that development, was that what comes with scale is also scaling up of all the problems that you see on the journal. Obviously, with the numbers of papers that the journal publishes, the number of research integrity issues that we see also scales up. And so I think that's something that's quite unique for those journals that are pretty large, that editors are exposed to the type of problems and the type of, ES integrity, but also other issues that on other journals, you could be an editor for like 10 years and maybe see something once or twice. And so this was also something that I just kind of welcomed because I've had a standing interest in research integrity. And so, that was interesting to me as well, I guess.
So firstly, thank you very much for that explanation. And it's great that you actually have already just touched on research integrity. When we talk about research integrity, what exactly do we mean by that? Are you able to define that?
I hope so. Although I think it's something that people will have differing opinions on what we mean by that. I would define research integrity as a totality of best practices that are governing how research should be done. And I should add that when I say how research should be done, I don't just mean how research is designed or executed, but also how it's disseminated. I think something that's like very often presented as separate issues is research integrity. So issues that relate to research itself, and then publishing ethics, which are issues that emerge during the publication process. I'm not sure that this is necessarily a helpful distinction, if not for other reason, that a lot of problems that we see during publication process originate with something that happened much earlier in their research life cycle. I think apart from talking about what my definition of research integrity is, it might be helpful to refer to the principles that the World Congress on Research Integrity came up about, I think, maybe 12 years ago or so. And so during that Congress, the committee designed sort of five principles that define what work done with integrity would look like. And I guess we'd say that for work to be done with integrity, it needs to be honest, it needs to be rigorous, transparent, and accountable. And the fifth principle was essentially one of respect. Everyone and everything that's involved in research needs to be treated with respect, be it your colleagues, be it study participants. And so this is like the broader definition that I think as a community we agree on when talking about research integrity.
So that being the case, could you give a basic overview of some of the types of misconduct that we're seeing and some of the reasons for that misconduct?
Yes. So I think I would maybe categorize the types of misconduct that we are seeing, especially in the last couple of years, into three categories. So these are things around falsification or fabrication of data or results. So misconduct that affects the content itself. These are issues around fabrication or some form of manipulation of authorship. So whether the credit we give for research is given to the right people. And finally, the manipulation or some form of corruption of the process would be the third one. And this involves various phenomena around corruption or some sort of perversion of the peer review and even editorial assessment. Now, where do they come from? I think that's a bit of a trickier question, to which just the standard answer is always perverse incentives, which that's something that has been around for a while. These incentives change, but they don't get weaker, so to speak. And I think part of that is why we see emergence of misconduct around manipulation of authorship and attempts to subvert the editorial process. But if you ask, you know, where the increase of these things is coming from and why do we see more of that, perhaps that the answer is simpler, and that's that visibility of these issues has changed over the last, I don't know, 10, 20, 25 years. And so certain forms of misconduct are easier to commit because of the tools that we have, or, you know, that people who commit it have. But at the same time, the ways to detect those problems are also something that started emerging. So we have more ways of identifying misconduct as well. I think one thing that's just very easy to forget is how new a lot of these tools are for a certain definition of new. You know, Identicate, which is essentially a service for detection of text overlaps, which can be a telltale sign of plagiarism. That's something that all of us use in publishing and everyone takes it for granted. But that as a service has only been introduced 20 years ago, CrossRev in 1999. Yes, 25 years sounds like a lot, but also it really isn't when you think about the history of publishing.
I do think that last point, though, was a really good one, that we haven't necessarily had the tools to see how much is occurring at such vast scale. And I think it's staggering. So then what are the risks and the implications of falsified data and other types of misconduct?
The major implications, which are essentially waste of resource. That is money, of course, but that is also time of researchers. That is also, I think, waste of talent. So the fact that when talking about the impact, for example, of retractions in research, we often talk about the impact on the careers of people whose papers are being retracted, but the impact on careers of people who couldn't carry on with their work because their resources were diverted to the research that then turned out to be fraudulent. I mean, that's something we don't talk about at all. And there is likely a lot of people who, you know, could have had thriving careers in research and have achieved things if they were given opportunity, but because they had to compete with something that was fraudulent, they just didn't have a chance. Another thing is also impact on the society. And I think especially in clinical research, that's something that, you know, is most pronounced. I often talk about the example of hydroxychloroquine and how it's been promoted in the early day of COVID pandemic. There's been a couple of studies that have then later been debunked and essentially shown to be flawed or just incorrect, that have been promoting hydroxychloroquine as this wonder drug for COVID. And there are multiple implications of that. Well, firstly, you've had a lot of very high profile politicians saying everyone should be using this and not all those other therapies that actually might have been better for the patients. There's been a lot of money poured into follow-up studies to show that it really works when it wasn't, but also a sort of maybe unintended but not completely unpredictable consequence was that that drug is actually a drug that is used for a lot of other diseases. It's used for treatment of malaria, it's used in treatment of lupus. And what happened after it became the sort of a promised drug for a while is that people went on the shopping spree. And there's been actually reported shortages of hydroxychloroquine in the clinical setting in which it is designed to be used. And so when you think about, it can be fraudulent, but I think we can also talk about research that's just badly designed. And in certain fields, I think that might be even worse than research that's outright fake. But the impact of that research being out on patients, those who would be using that drug, but also a lot of others who would be using something else, but the money has been diverted towards waste. I mean, the impact on those people is something that we can't ignore, but somehow we do all the time. So it's pretty sad if you think about it.
Yeah, and actually one thing that I just want to raise that I think people won't necessarily think about. I think we all get the implications in terms of the false information that gets out there and the damage of that. But there were two points that you raised that I think people won't necessarily have thought through. And the first of those is the resourcing piece and the careers that could have been that weren't. But then the second one, of course, is the fact that misinformation can lead to scarcity and negative patient outcomes, not just because people are going, here's a thing that has no clinical evidence, but I'm going to use it. But it's also, here's a thing that has no clinical evidence, and so I'm going to take away that resource. I think that you're raising issues that people just won't necessarily have thought through, which is both terrifying but also enlightening. So thank you. And on that point, I'm actually now going to hand over to Meredith for the next question.
Thanks, Sarah. And thanks, Raphael, for the foundation so far. And yeah, I agree with Sarah. Some interesting points raised that we haven't necessarily thought about or talked about before. I'd like to turn now to the mitigation side, now that we have a little bit of an understanding of what research integrity is and what are some of the risks and implications. Can we start by just talking a little bit about whose responsibility is on the mitigation side when it comes to research integrity and what the different roles and responsibilities are?
That's one of the biggest sticking points when it comes to talking about how to handle research integrity issues. Editors see a lot of that. There is an expectation from the community that when someone reports potential misconduct, that, you know, we're just going to go and straight away retract the paper, but then also punish the author somehow. And I just wish more people understood that I just don't have jurisdiction to do that. You know, I don't have means, but also authority to punish anyone. And I think that speaks to how that responsibility should be divided and where different bits of it should sit. Editors and publishers do have responsibility for content. We have to be able to stand by what we publish. And integrity of scientific record is something that is, or at least should be, the first thing that we think about when concerns are raised with the journal of individual editors. But the thing that we don't have control over and have really little power to do anything about is people and their behavior. And I think that's something that really, in terms of responsibility, should sit with research institutions, with funders, and also with the community itself. We don't have power over what people do is one part of it, but maybe a bigger issue is also that the human behaviors that need to be changed, whether it's through education or prevention of some sort, again, they happen much earlier in the research cycle. So when the paper comes to the journal, you know, whatever issues may emerge later, at the point of submission, those issues were already there. So this is not the point when you can change what happens. Where you can change it is when you teach people. I think this is something that I've not really seen happen in many places in the world. I actually strongly believe that education about research integrity and research ethics is something that should be part of like the most basic curriculum at universities. You know, it cannot be a add-on 5-hour course that you make your PhD students to do in their last year of PhD when they've already done the research. And if any of them were to do something that's inappropriate, they would have done this already. And so the responsibility for that, for how we train and teach people about what research integrity is, and by that also what honest and rigorous and transparent research is, that has to sit with the institutions that have the ability to do that. And these are universities. And as I said, to some degree, also the funders.
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought out the different responsibilities that exist in the different players and stakeholders. And I know you've mentioned before that it's a shared responsibility sort of across the major players in the industry. Do you think there's any role that publishers should be playing that they're currently not? Any gaps in that, or any, I guess I'm sort of thinking about this from the perspective of collaboration, right? Sort of sharing the responsibility and working together to make sure that those gaps are filled. Do you see any opportunities there that we're not currently taking advantage of?
Where we can help is the education part, because most of the things, when they come to light, come during publishing process. I think publishers and editors have probably the best visibility of what issues may emerge during research that essentially constitute misconduct. And so maybe we are in a good place to identify those and then feedback. Now, how you do this, I don't quite know. I think that's a tricky one. How do you take that knowledge and package it as something that can be used by institutions all over the world to build it into, for example, a standard curriculum? Obviously, we do organize various forms of trainings that researchers can take and learn about those things sort of in their own time. But, you know, how do you do this as a collaboration with the whole academic community in the world? I don't know. It's just too big of a question, I think, for me to answer here.
Yes, I don't expect you to answer that one here. Sara mentioned earlier that Scientific Reports is the world's largest journal. Journals obviously come in different shapes and sizes, different workflows, different resources. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the research integrity efforts at Scientific Reports from the perspective of a mega journal, which I'm sure comes with many challenges in this space?
I'd be happy to, because we do a lot of work in that space, but I think a lot of that is actually not very visible, and that might be actually a good thing. I mean, you don't necessarily want these things to be visible, especially when they work well. So I will say that when we think about Scientific Reports' strategy of how to approach research integrity, this sort of relies on three aspects, I would say, and they aren't really very different for us than they are for anybody else. So the first one is training. We make sure to provide, especially our editors and our reviewers, with appropriate training so that they understand what ethical editing and ethical reviewing is supposed to look like, but then also to identify potential problems in the research they handle. We do manage to filter out quite a lot for them, but there are things that are just not easy to spot if you're not an expert in the field. And so we're trying to make sure that our editors have a framework to use, so that when they spot something that, you know, only they can, as experts, spot, they know what the next steps should be. The other aspect that we rely on quite a lot is prevention. And I think something to say about that is that, obviously, I said at the beginning that we are a big journal, and what comes with scale is also a larger number of problems that we see. But being large is also a blessing in disguise, in that it allows us to, firstly, spot patterns. So if we see something that's a new type of misconduct, I think it's easier for large journals to identify it than it would be for a journal that might see it as a one-off. And then if we manage to identify patterns, it also means that it's easier for us to design workflows and processes around it, so that we can then use those patterns to essentially identify problematic research and filter it out. Just get it out of the system before it even goes to our editors and waste their time and potentially peer reviewers' time. And so the scalability is actually working to our advantage. And that's how we focus our prevention. Try to make sure that for things that are in particular repetitive problems, we design systematic workflows that are straightforward enough that, you know, a well-trained editorial support staff member can handle those most of the time, and that it's fairly easy to have discussions with our board members, academic editors, on how to handle those if there's something slightly more complicated. As I said, it's nice to talk about this because that's something that readers usually don't see. When you have problems that identified in the papers that were published, you only see the things that go through the net. You don't see a wealth of everything that was caught because we have these processes in place in the first place. And the third aspect of how we look at research integrity is essentially reaction to things that already are published and something happens. Someone raises concerns with us that there are some sort of issues with the paper. That's pretty standard. We just look at every concern that is raised with the journal. We have our own workflows in place, but obviously also COPE guidelines to rely on. Fortunately, we also have support from colleagues within the publisher's research integrity group who sort of supplement some of our own efforts. But that, I would say, is pretty routine. I think that's what everyone is doing. You know, if you have something flagged to you as a problem, you just look at it, investigate it, and decide if it needs to be corrected or retracted, or perhaps nothing needs to happen.
Thank you. And I think you brought out something really important, which is I think it can be easy to assume that at bigger journals, there are just more resources to throw at these problems. And to an extent, that's true, right? But it's also, you still have all the same questions you have to answer around identifying patterns, using tools, because there's such a scale and volume that you can't just throw more and more resources at something. You also have to have protocols and mechanisms for actually using those resources effectively. So in some ways, it's just the same problem at a different scale.
It's very true. And I hope people aren't assuming that we're just having a ton of resources to throw at problems because, because we don't. But also, I think trying to figure out how you work around those problems using appropriate workflows is something that can be very helpful. And the bigger the journal, the more important it is so that you can actually manage your resources in a way that's smart and sensible and sustainable. But it also means that some of the things become a bit easier to manage.
Yes, and I can relate to some of these assumptions. I work for Elsevier, so there's always sort of an assumption that if you work for a bigger infrastructure that you don't have to think about the same questions, but you certainly do. So I want to just switch gears a little bit here. It would be kind of strange to have a conversation about research integrity without talking about AI a little bit. So I want to get your thoughts about what AI has already brought and what you think it will bring, both positively and negatively, to the research integrity discussion.
I should preface anything I say by saying that I am a bit, not a lot, but a bit of a AI skeptic, and mostly in the context of the sort of the latest, you know, generative AI tools in terms of how they can help or not help peer review processes, I guess. In terms of, I think maybe having said that, talking about the negative impact of AI on publishing, I think that's probably easier one to talk about because we already see that and quite a lot of it. It's becoming easier than ever to generate papers that are most likely nonsense, but it's more difficult now to actually say this is nonsense. And to clarify what I mean by that, if you look on those almost historical hoaxes where people were generating just gibberish paper, I think SciGen was the first one that was tested for that as a tool that was generating those like gibberish paper in computer sciences, I believe. If you look at those papers, you can actually say they are gibberish. You can't often say that as easily with content generated with like the latest generation of LLM-based models, which, you know, is quite scary, honestly, especially that we don't have a counterpart in terms of models that can detect that kind of text. And so it is a big risk for us. I think long-term, it's only going to increase burden on people who assess research and on how peer review works because of the way people essentially approach reading papers when they peer review them or edit them. I think most researchers don't scrutinize every sentence and every comma and every full stop in the paper to figure out whether it's really been written by a human being and whether it's a representation of a true study or not. And we are going in the direction where that might be necessary. Another place where I personally have some fears of where we're going and the risks that AI is bringing is fabrication of data. I said at the beginning that tools that we have now just make misconduct much easier than it used to be. And so if you think, for example, about how you can manipulate or somehow in a different way, sort of falsify results in molecular biology, where people love using Western blots or all sorts of other blots for their experiments, If you think about how it looked like 30 or 40 years ago, you just have essentially photographs that you'd have to do something with them. Then 20 years ago, people started using sort of image editing tools, and you could maybe touch up an image here and there and maybe just copy paste some bits here and there. And today you can literally use Adobe with their plugin, which I think is called Firefly, I believe, that essentially allows you to take an image from a research paper and then just fill up the space with something that looks the same. So you can literally generate something that looks like a research result, but is completely fake. And the thing is that I've experimented with that a little myself, and I don't think that people will be able to say, you know, this, I mean, maybe Western blots are an actually good example of that, but microscopy images in particular, you know, the cell microscopy, you look at those, and I think even experts might not be able to say, is this image a true piece of data, or is it something that was effectively painted by the generative AI in the tools that most people have access to? So these things are quite scary to think of. Apologies for starting with doom and gloom. And I don't know that necessarily there are easy answers to how we're going to deal with that, I should say, other than completely rethinking how we verify the data we see in the papers and how we go about the whole certification by peer review process. But there are tools that are, you know, not necessarily based on LLM models, but, you know, different forms of machine learning, other types of models that are used to detect those problems as well. So this is the flip end. You know, I said it's easier to fabricate the data, but some things are easier to detect. I think one of the reasons that we're seeing an increase of cases involving duplicated images is because there are AI-based tools available that essentially detect duplication between papers, and often between papers that are published by different journals, different publishers, that can go back, you know, decades. So as long as the image from the paper is available somewhere, and at the very least, anything that's open access will be, if that image is reused anywhere, you can detect it now. And so, yes, some of the tools also let us detect some of the problems. Not generated text, I don't think that's going to be an easy solution for us, but, you know, in other spaces, those tools can help.
The point you made earlier about tools being fairly new in the grand scheme of publishing, I think is relevant to what you're talking about here too, because although tools are fairly new, the development of those tools has increased in speed rapidly in recent years, right? Because of the rise in availability of ways to falsify data and that becoming more of a common practice. That gives me some optimism that there is a lot of work going on to really focus on developing tools that are going to make the detection side easier and sort of catch the detection side up with the falsifying side, which hasn't happened yet.
Maybe something I should say is that there are actually tools that are based on various forms of AI that I think indirectly are going to help with that. So something that we see quite a lot is that papers that have those type of problems with, you know, essentially fabricated content, they often come with some form of manipulation of authorship, for example. And so there are ways of analyzing the authorships and authorship networks of different papers, and also looking at references in particular. Certain red flags that come up through those analyses can indicate that the whole paper is essentially fraudulent. And so us not being able to spot something in content itself doesn't mean that we can't spot that there is a problem in the paper. And I think in that space, the tools that are being developed are going to be much more powerful and will be used much more by publishers. And I think it's probably where maybe a lot more effort and resources are going to go. It's not to say that I don't see the light at the end of the tunnel. I think there is a lot of effort that goes into certain types of tools that sometimes maybe indirectly, but still help us identify things that are problematic and hopefully deal with them before they reach publication or even editorial desk, if we do this well.
Yeah, and your skepticism is certainly fair and warranted and shared, I'm sure, by many who will listen to this. I'm glad also that you brought up authorship. We haven't talked a lot about authorship and paper mills because this topic is so huge and we could be here for a while talking about all these different things. And I think it's a good segue into almost the last question here, which is that our audience is mostly early career professionals in the scholarly publishing industry. Do you have any advice on how people can stay sort of up to date in the area of research integrity and at least sort of try to understand foundationally what's going on there, because it is moving quickly and it can be overwhelming. So what are your thoughts about how early career professionals in particular can stay up to speed?
I think the problem with this for me is that I've had interest in research integrity so long that at the time when I started, there actually was very few sources. And so I kind of grew my knowledge and experience in that as the field of, like, you know, essentially research on research integrity, I guess, erupted. But if I was to start today, I wouldn't know where to start, if I'm honest. I can maybe only recommend just trying to identify sources where you can just get your latest news on either projects or initiatives, or sometimes like very sort of medial cases that come to light that can be a good case studies for how research integrity issues are identified and then can be dealt with. But beyond that, I don't know that I'd be able to offer much more. I mean, I can probably plug some newsletters that are not mine, I should say. So I personally subscribe to two newsletters. One is James Butcher's Journalology, which is generally about publishing, but James often has, you know, links and sort of comments on various research integrity related content that is appearing, whether it's actual research papers or just opinion pieces or anything like that. I also subscribe to Chris Leonard's newsletter called Scaling that is focused on the use of AI in peer review. Which I guess would be very topical from what we've just talked about. I get a lot of information from those. I don't know how would you go about when you're just starting. It's a difficult place to be these days because there is a lot happening. It can be overwhelming. And I think it's also very easy for people who come into publishing right now with maybe little experience of those issues and problems to see bigger problems than they are, just because of the attention some issues may be getting in the media, and then to dismiss things that are actual true problems because they're not getting as much attention. So this is, you know, this is not something that I think is very good advice, but I guess just knowing that maybe sometimes we have to take a step back and try to trim all the humbug from whatever you're reading about in the press to figure out what the core issue is, that might help figuring out, am I actually looking at something that's like a serious problem, or is it just a problem that sells well in the press and there are other issues that maybe deserve my attention a bit more?
I think that is very good advice. And you've also, I think, helped to reassure people that it's okay to be a little overwhelmed and that even with a lot of experience, it can be hard to find an entry point. So I actually think that's a really important way to answer that question. And we will provide links to those two newsletters that you mentioned in the Scholarly Kitchen post that goes along with this episode, so people can take a look at those if they're interested. Well, thank you very much for taking the time to do this. We really appreciate it. I know we asked you some questions that just don't have clear answers. So we really appreciate you taking the time to think these through with us and talk about them.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much to Rafael for taking time to talk to us today. As we heard today, research integrity is such a complex topic with so many facets, and I hope today's conversation helped our audience to understand at least some of the foundational elements and implications and how far the reach of this topic can be. As always, we welcome your feedback on this podcast and any other topics that you want to hear about from us. So thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you back here for our next episode.